de un apartamento pulga infestado, vienen los livings de un hombre encantador. ¡It's Bat Segundo!
Once again for those deafening arribas. Kids, this is Bat Segundo, and the people who bankroll this podcast have once again failed to pay my bills. It's cold and I'm shivering, and I gnawed at my trusty wool blanket for food at some point, but I don't quite remember when or how. But I have my good friend Johnny Walker here, although in light of this week's guest, I should probably be clutching a bottle of Sterling or perhaps a bottle of crystal champagne. Not that I could ever afford that, but no matter. You may have heard of our guest, Bret Easton Ellis. He's the writer of Less Than Zero and American Psycho, and he's just turned out another novel called Lunar Park. This one features a narrator named Bret Easton Ellis, and it had me quite confused. He may or may not be the man who our young roving correspondent interviewed. We'll let you be the judge in this very revealing interview.
Now, I read a Suicide Girls interview. You said that you were initially responding to questions in the form of the two Bretts. Did you want to try to take another stab at that, or?
It became exhausting.
Really?
It became, like, exhausting during the first or second interview. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it anymore. I just didn't have the energy. And I also really didn't feel the need anymore. I mean, when I began to see how people were responding to the book, I mean, I wanted to respond back genuinely, and there was no need to.
Yeah,
there was no need to. I didn't really want to play a game anymore.
But then again, it was a serious interviewer, as opposed to someone like me who may have a sense of humor.
Well, no, if you have a sense of humor, that's all the better. That's completely fine. But maybe that'll activate something in me. Maybe that'll activate the other Bret. I don't know. We can see. We can see how it turns out. But I don't know. I think that other Bret is really just going to have to stay between covers.
Okay.
And he's not drifting around out here anymore, I don't think. Though he did briefly for one or two interviews.
Okay. The first line of Lunar Park, or the first line that eventually we get to, is you do an awfully good impression of yourself. How much of the Bret in Lunar Park is an impression? Would you consider this impression an awfully good one? Or?
You know, it's an impression of me, but it's also pretty much an accurate representation of me. Maybe the worst of me, I don't know. Maybe the part of me that I don't like to see in the mirror, the part that I don't like to think about so much. But because of the story of Lunar Park and of the events that happen in this book, and because it is a supernatural novel and it's a ghost story, the Bret in it has to become a character responding to these events with a kind of anxiety and a horror that, no, of course I don't share. Of course I wasn't attacked by poltergeists. Of course I wasn't attacked by a vicious monster.
Or appear on the Facts of Life.
And I didn't appear on the Facts of Life either. So, you know, on a certain emotional level, yeah, I'm there. But that's true with every book. I was there with Patrick Bateman, too. I mean, if you're writing a book and the book is being narrated by someone, I mean, you're channeling it from somewhere, and you have to identify on a certain level with whoever you're dealing with, even if it's someone as, you know, muddle-headed as Victor Ward. I mean, I saw parts of myself in that character as well.
Now, I understand that the character of Bret actually started off initially as a fictional author. What made you decide to sort of take on this sort of metafictional role?
I couldn't write the book. I was stuck. 10 years on an outline.
Mm-hmm.
10 years on an outline that pretty much is the book you're holding in your hand. It's that is the book that I was going to write with a fictional protagonist, another writer who was very similar to me, who had written books very similar to mine and had the same kind of career trajectory. When I sat down to write this book in the summer of 2000, I couldn't started, and I didn't understand why. I mean, because I was really revved up. I was really psyched to write it, and then the little writer that I have in my head said, "Why didn't you just make him Bret Easton Ellis? My God, he resembles you in every way. Just use your name."
So there may be the third Bret Easton Ellis inside your head here.
Exactly. if anyone can follow that. But so yeah, and so once a decision was made, well, I had to change some things, but you know, I had to name the actual novels, and I had to quote from them, and I had to use certain references from my past instead of the fictional references I had already planned to use in the book. But it wasn't that hard of a technical thing to jump over. And it was really inspiring. But I didn't set out to write a metafictional horror novel. I guess what happened ultimately is because when I made that decision, well, automatically it became that way. And I just thought, well, hell, I'm telling a ghost story.
Now
I'm not writing a David Foster Wallace novel.
Gotcha. Well, now, when you decided on the metafictional angle, I was wondering... Now, first of all, metafiction seems to be increasingly sort of embraced by popular writers. Stephen King, of course, wrote himself into the last three volumes of The Dark Tower. There's a character named Philip Roth in Operation Shylock. I was wondering if these sort of served as a kind of examples for you to use, or if you went back straight to sort of the metafictional originators such as Robert Coover or John Barth, or even, you know, later on down the line, William T. Fulman.
I wasn't thinking of a single one of them. Okay. I was simply going on my own. And even though I'd read all of the books that you've talked about, I've read all of the authors you've talked about, no, because the book wasn't planned as that. Mm. It wasn't planned as that. And I had read all of those books before this, and I didn't use any other examples. I really wanted to tell – I wanted to write a genre book, and I wanted to write an homage to Stephen King, and it became something different along down the line. But this was not ever in my mind while I was writing it. I never thought, okay, I'm writing a metafictional novel. I thought I was writing a very, very simple, very basic ghost story.
Well, still, though, the first 20 pages of the book is a very sort of funny kind of overview of this Bret Easton Ellis that appears. So it's part of it seems to be very, very focused on this metafictional persona.
But that chapter was always there with the fictional writer because I had to get him out of his life in New York and had to show how far he fell and how he wound up married, reunited with his son, and living in suburbia. So that chapter was there no matter what. It was just... a fictional guy. And in a lot of ways, I'm sorry that I lost that, because I think some of the parodies that I did of my own work, especially in those first couple of pages where he quotes the four novels that he's published so far, were a lot funnier than the ones that I had to ultimately use because I was using Bret Easton Ellis. So no, it was just a matter of, okay, just a lot of these details have to change. But some of the most outlandish aspects in that first chapter were originally in that first chapter when it was a fictional character.
So you potentially sort of, I guess, underplayed the satire by actually deciding upon putting yourself into it, or?
I don't know. I thought it, it was, the choice was kind of made out of desperation in a way, because I was blocked and I didn't understand why. And once, for whatever reason, that idea popped into my head and I decided to gamble and run with it, you know, the book essentially stayed the same for me, except that it did become a much more personal thing. But structurally, I don't think there's a single chapter that was changed because of that one choice being made.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the influence of Stephen King. There's actually many homages in Lunar Park. There is, for example, I mentioned before, you know, Stephen King wrote himself into the last three volumes of The Dark Tower.
I didn't make it through the last three volumes of The Dark Tower.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
How about the first two?
Really?
How many are there? There's seven, right?
There's a total of seven.
Yeah.
Yeah. He released all three in a back-to-back-to-back.
That's when I first read the three. And I don't know why I haven't, but anyway, okay.
Well, anyway, there's that. There's, for example, the cop who closely reads the author's book, which reminded me of the cop from Misery. And, of course...
Interesting. Didn't catch on to that. No,
oh, yeah. Well, that's what struck me. And then there's, like, the world moving on from The Dark Tower, as well as the Cujo-esque sort of Turby. And also, I noticed, Word Processor of the Gods with the technological malfunctioning, or even the writer sort of creating the world. And even the actual prose itself at some points has the sort of parenthetical, you know, thought which he really uses in the last three volumes of The Dark Tower. So I was sort of surprised that you haven't read that.
Oh, but that was from Salem's Lot on. That was in The Shining.
Well,
that was in.
It certainly was, but he really relied on it in like the last three volumes.
Ah.
But I wanted to know why Stephen King? Why not, for example, Robert Bloch or H.P. Lovecraft? Since there were so many, to me anyway, very clear. motifs that were sort of, you know, lifted or put into your work as homage. Why King above, say, another Horrormeister? Or why, you know, why not a congerie of multiple authors?
Because he was my favorite.
Okay.
He was my favorite. He was the one that I liked the most. And what happened was, after living with Patrick Bateman for 3 years and working on American Psycho, I wanted to write something fun. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that it wasn't fun writing American Psycho, and not that I don't think that American Psycho can be a very funny, entertaining novel, despite how dark it can also be. But I wanted to write a book that gave me the kind of pleasure that I got when I was a boy and an adolescent. And, you know, if I had to look at what it was usually genre fiction. It was, you know, ghost stories, it was supernatural thrillers, or it was international espionage thrillers a la Robert Ludlum, things like that. And so that was really where the impetus to write Lunar Park came from. I wanted to go back to when I was a boy and write the kind of book that I liked reading.
Well, what was it about Stephen King specifically that has drawn you?
The first. He was the first. You know, it's always the first, isn't it? Mm. And Stephen King was the first. And I remember picking up Carrie when I was like, I don't know, 10? Yeah. Jesus, I was a pretty precocious reader. And I read Carrie when I was 10. And I was hooked from then on. And then when Salem's Lot came out the following year, I think in 75, I read it like 11 times during that summer. I couldn't put it down. And then The Shining, and on and on and on. And up until when I was a college student and beyond, I was a big fan. And so looking back, I was thinking about what were the books that gave you the greatest pleasure of when you were that age. And it was Stephen King's work, and it was just because he was the first, I guess. And also, I think because he was able to modernize the horror genre in a way that I hadn't seen in other horror fiction, and that really was something I responded to, unlike Poe or Lovecraft. Mm-hmm. And I was heavily influenced by the Warren comics of the 70s. I loved Eerie, I loved Creepy, I loved mm-hmm. Vampirilla, I loved the EC comics, the Vault of Horror Tales from the Crypt. So it was, you know, it was kind of a mix of those two, and I wanted to do something that was an homage to all that stuff that I loved.
Well, I actually, it's interesting to me now that you mentioned this love of King. You specialize, for example, in your books in brand name description, and there happens to be a little bit of that in King's work too. Like, there's one image in, I can't remember which King book, but he describes this sort of piggy bank of like a whole bunch of nickels in a scooped out Skippy peanut butter jar. And it's a very strange kind of juxtaposition of this consumerist kind of, you know, Skippy peanut butter that everyone sees with the actual change itself.
But see, I never understood the whole questioning of using brand names in fiction. It's never made any sense to me. I've never understood like people's interest in that, or why it's a question, or why it's an issue. It's always, I mean, growing up, I never really had a problem with that when I read it in fiction. But I was told when I went to college, for example. I mean, now of course I know the issue, but yeah. I mean, there was a lot of. It was happening a lot when I first started writing, the idea that using brand names in literary fiction is a no-no, and you can't do it because what it does is it dates your work, and you know, don't you want to be like this timeless writer whose work reads on and on and on for people 100 years from now? Who, if you're sitting around and you're caring about that, it's like, oh God, get a life. You know, you're probably writing the deadest fiction anyone could ever write about. Right, and so I am, and since I'm writing about contemporary society, and since I'm, detailing contemporary culture, that just has to be part of it. But that was one thing about King that was very striking the first time out.
Really, the brand name description that he used.
Totally, yeah. Well, and so, it was scary.
Yeah.
The books were scary. The books scared me as a kid, you know? Yeah. So.
Well, an MFA might argue, though, that sometimes a gabardine overcoat is just a gabardine overcoat. Why not just go ahead and say something is like a pink silk scarf? Rather, why does it have to be sort of associated with a brand name?
You know what? It doesn't have to be either. It can be anything you want. Every writer's different. Every writer's a snowflake. You know, every writer can do whatever they want. There are no rules. So, you know, a writer can do that. But that's just not my temperament, my sensibility.
There's no sort of like specific sort of subtext to this brand name description.
Well, I suppose to a degree in American Psycho, because of how crazy he was. Yeah, I guess there was in that. But certainly I didn't feel that way in Lesson Zero or Rules of Attraction or Glamorama. Or no, this was just this was just trying to, I was just trying to capture as accurately as possible who these narrators were, what their lives revolved around, and I tried to stay as true to them as possible, and that was just part of the that was just part of what they noticed, and I didn't give it another thought, really.
Now, in terms of Lunar Park, going back to this, Lunar Park, as you've conveyed, is sort of largely an homage, you would say.
Yeah, I would say so, yes.
Do you think that that there is value in a novel that is exclusively homage, or is there something more to Lunar Park that people need to be demystified by?
Well, ultimately, you know, a lot. Yeah, I mean, what started out as an exercise in genre over a 10-year period because of a lot of things I experienced became something very different. I mean, it did not come out as a strictly, you know, bare bones haunted house tale. I mean, the things that really directly affected me during those 10 years before I sat down to write Lunar Park were the death of my father, and so that entered into the outline. I realized, okay, because what was this guy that I was writing about? Why was he haunted, and why was the house he was in haunted? What was haunting him? And then that was an answer for me, that the father was the ghost of the father was going to be a big part of the novel. And also the
one of many Hamlet references, too.
One of many Hamlet references, exactly. And also there was the publication and the success, ultimate success, of American Psycho. And I had a kind of strange resentment towards that book's popularity and towards Patrick Bateman becoming such an iconic figure. I mean, it is the book that I am going to be remembered for, and it will be the first line in every obituary that is written about me, if there are any written about me. But that is, and there's a certain resentment that goes with that. And I think the metaphors in the novel of a writer being very haunted by something he created, and that does get out of control, that you cannot control as a writer. The world controls, you know, you can't control the world's response to your work. And then I became very interested in what it means to do what I do. I became very interested in the whole idea of what does it mean to be a person who sits in a room all day creating fiction? What kind of man is that? And so that also entered into the novel, and there was a lot of musings about the writing process weaved throughout Lunar Park. And so it changed it. It changed it a lot. Mm-hmm. What my original ideas were for the book, and when I finally got it all, you know, worked out and it was all set up, I was blocked, and then I just had to change the name.
Have you read B.J. Johnson's Like a Fiery Elephant?
No.
Well, it tells this. I'm sorry, Jonathan Coe's Like a Fiery Elephant, which is a biography
of Lovecraft.
B.S. Johnson.
Okay, I'm seeing the Michelle Welbeck thing. Okay. I haven't read it, but it's recent. It just came out, right?
It just came out recently. Yeah.
Well, anyway, but I love Jonathan Coe's work.
Oh, well, you'll really love this. It's a very unusual sort of biography that's put together with various letters. But the thing that's very interesting, it tells about this very obscure British avant-garde writer named B.S. Johnson. And there's one moment in the book where Jonathan Coe sort of says, you know, it's very difficult for us to sort of write a sort of galvanizing biography here, because the thing that he most enjoyed was sitting in that sort of room.
Right.
You know, writing, basically, doing the act of writing. Yeah. And from a dramaturgical standpoint, from a narrative standpoint, there's not really a lot you can do with that. And yet, in Johnson's mind, he was perfectly content doing that. Was this sort of contributory towards the problem you might have been having? Or?
I think the problem that I was having was that I had gone too long without actually working on the book. And I was subsumed by this other novel that took far longer to write than I had anticipated. And so
it's interesting you have not yet mentioned Glamorama. Sort of interested in that. Yeah,
Glamorama. Yeah, that was the book that kind of like consumed me during the 90s and took far longer to write than I ever imagined. And so I think by the time I finished that, I was exhausted. I was really tired. And then I had done a very long tour around the world to support that book. And then when I came down back to New York and sat at my desk in the summer of 2000 to write Lunar Park, I think I was tired, and I think if I had given it maybe 3 or 4 months, I could have written it, and it wouldn't have been Brett Easton Ellis. But I really, something was calling for me to write the book. And if I ever have writer's block, mm-hmm. if it ever happens, I just get up and walk away. I'll do something. I'll go to movies for a week, or I'll go someplace else, or I'll read books or something. But this time out, I couldn't walk away. So something had to be done. And that was the thing that had to be done, I guess. But it's scary. I just realized it right now that if I had waited throughout that summer and started in September of 2000, it would not have been Brett Easton Ellis, probably. I probably would have worked it out, and it would have been another narrator.
Hmm.
Oh, interesting.
That is
okay.
Interesting. Well, now that it actually is a Brett Easton Ellis,
yeah.
I'm wondering, you had mentioned in other interviews, I noted, that you had actually read your books again. I'm wondering if you had actually gone through any of the press clippings or the articles that had been written about you to sort of mine for details, or was it sort of a purely kind of instinctive sort of process of invention?
It was a purely instinctive process of invention. What I did was I took the original notes that I had planned for this fictional writer, and just then embellished them with my stuff and gave him my history, because it was pretty much structured in your traditional rise and fall, you know, biopic kind of manner, where, you know, there's this awesome rise, and then there's this tragic fall, and then there's the redemption, then the hand is being reached out, and he decides to move forward. That was always there.
Okay. Well, 10 years on an outline is actually something else. In a 1994 Observer interview, I noted that you had said, "Life has no narrative. Why should books?" I'm just curious about this, because much of your work is sort of episodic in nature. Do you find plot a burden? How closely do you adhere to these outlines, or are these outlines sort of a way for you to kind of find the story or find the voice in the process?
I have found that the older I've gotten, there is more plot in my books, and that there is more narrative, and that there are stories, and that Lunar Park is actually, for a novel, pretty single-minded in its focus.
Mm-hmm.
It is someone telling you directly a very simple story that happened to him over a period of 12 days. I think what happens is as you get older, you begin to realize that people lives have narratives to them, and that actually if you stick around long enough, you realize that people have histories, and that life is a series of narratives. I don't think you're that aware of that. I don't think you're that aware of it when you're younger, and you feel that you feel it doesn't, because you haven't experienced enough and you haven't been around long enough to grasp that. And that's why I think that a lot of writing done by young people tends to be fairly formless and episodic, or purposefully experimental and not very direct in terms of story and plot and character. And I think it's so. I think it's just an involuntary part of the aging process. I mean, it's just that's now what I'm more interested in. And I'm certainly not interested in whatever I was doing in '94 or
Glamorama, then, with the sort of fashion plotting that you had in that.
I could never
write the secret message, the photo soap, and all that.
No, I could never do that.
Oh.
I could never write that book again.
Huh.
Never would want to write that book again, or American Psycho again. I mean, it's, you know, I'm not the same guy at 41 that I was when I was, you know, 23, 24, 25. Oh, there's some, you know, semblance, but still, it's different people.
Okay. Well, I wanted to sort of actually talk about you growing older. In 1991, you wrote an essay in which you accounted for the generation born between 1961 and 1971, which would, of course, still be you.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote, "Since contemporary subversiveness is all on the surface, popular culture doesn't, it can't jolt us in ways it did previous generations. We're basically unshockable, and so culture doesn't play the same role in our lives that it did for previous generations to liberate, break boundaries, show the unshowable." Do you still believe that your generation or the generation after can even be shocked? Are there boundaries left to break? Or does any of what you wrote in that essay still apply to you today?
Well, 9/11.
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't that sort of destroy my thesis? Doesn't that sort of, like, make everything that I said minimal, puny, full of crap, in a way? I mean, if we're talking about the horror of you know, the world we live in and that we have to deal with, fiction can't touch it. I mean, that's just not ever going to happen.
Yeah.
But in terms of, we're just talking about popular culture, which is what I was riffing on when I wrote that piece.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I do believe that. I still stick to that. And I know very, very few people of my generation who were so shocked by my novels that they got into an uproar about it. It was the older left who were up in arms about me, and it was the older critical community, though the younger critical community still now has problems with me too, but to a much lesser degree, and they tend to treat me with some, you know, modicum of respect, even when they're dissing me. So, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. Is there something that in popular culture, not in the world, that really is that even something that people feel the need to do now in popular culture? I don't know.
However, you know, shortly after September 11th, you had the end of irony was declared. Only, you know, it took like The Onion, for example, to actually break that sort of, to pop that cherry, so to speak.
Well, it should have been popped. Yeah. And I mean, I kind of understand why that comment was made, and it was very suggestive. It was a very interesting comment to have been made at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, and it did resonate powerfully, even though now in retrospect you realize, well, no, that's not true, and that's not ever going to be true. I mean, the world is a very ironic place, and no.
Well, simultaneously, though, the limits, one might argue that the limits actually have been restricted. You know, the Nipplegate incident with Janet Jackson. I mean, that's a clear case of, you know, to me, it spells out the boundaries right now are just closing in gradually more and more and more. So as a novelist, I'm sure that you must feel some sort of, you know, element of horror that the sort of, I guess, expanse that you have to write in is narrowing.
I don't feel that way personally. Yeah. I don't feel that way within a novel. I feel that way in terms of screenwriting, and I feel that in Hollywood, for example, it is very frustrating because you can't, I mean, if you write a script and you have drugs in it, you're automatically going to get an R rating, no matter if there's no violence or nudity in it. So
even if it's Ritalin.
yeah, to a degree. And so, I mean, that when there's that much money at stake, yeah, our culture is extremely conservative. But you know, maybe that's a good thing, because then maybe there'll be some backlash, and you can even tell there are hints of it coming out. There's hints of a post 9/11 mood in the arts that I don't know is heartening, I think, in a way. And I don't think people just want everything sanitized and cleaned up for them. I mean, though yet again, I'm going to backtrack, because I do think that the generation that I'm in, the generation of parents that I'm a part of, though I'm not a parent, are overly concerned about protecting their children from the realities of the world. And I don't know. I don't know what kind of generation these kids are going to make up. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit worrisome. They're so overprotected, so medicated, so controlled. It's like, what's going to happen?
Well, there you have actually one of the high points, I think, of Lunar Park are the various sort of pretty much whole suburban families are medicated on antidepressants. And the thing I particularly enjoyed was the trick-or-treating, going from house to house in an SUV. So there's a part of you in this book that is still sort of, I guess what I'm trying to get at here is how much of Bret Easton Ellis, the novelist, not the persona, is a cultural observer? How much of your writing do you feel is a responsibility to that?
No responsibility to that, but I do feel that, yeah, I'm a cultural observer just because I'm part of the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, I watch television, I read newspapers, I read books, I'm on, you know, I'm online all the time. I mean, I don't know, maybe it seeps in. But also I think as a writer of fiction, you have a kind of antenna that goes out there, and your feelers, or whatever you want to call them, move in certain directions, and you notice things that, you know, maybe other people, because they're not writers, don't particularly care to notice or don't particularly want to notice. And then when you're sitting down and you're writing, you're able to, you've processed all this stuff you've witnessed, and it's in your back cabinets, and you're able to pull from it whenever you need it when you're working on a novel. And so I think that's just simply what it is. Yeah, I'm interested in culture, and I like following contemporary culture.
Well, you once mentioned that there wasn't a young writer that you hadn't read. And I'm wondering if this is still the case. Do you keep track of Jonathan Safran Foer or Nick McDonald?
Oh, both of them, yeah. Yeah, I'm friends with Nick. I've known Nick since he was three.
Okay.
Let's put it that way. And I was not three, okay? Yeah, I've read Nick McDonald, and I've read Jonathan Safran Foer. And yeah, I like them. I like them.
So
I think they're good.
You're still sort of obsessed with young writers in this kind of degree, or are you
no.
more sort of gravitating towards people who might be your age?
Or dead,
okay.
Oh, yeah, I definitely am. Or no, older than me. I mean, I am not... My favorite writers are probably all in their 60s and 70s. They're Philip Roth, and they're Don DeLillo, and they're Joan Didion, I mean, among American living writers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I'm interested in anything that's good. I'm always opening books. I always have a ton of hope every time I open a book that it's going to take me someplace that I have never been before, and it's going to be a transporting experience, no matter how old the writer is.
Okay. The great novelist Stanley Elkin once mentioned that he didn't know he was a comedian until his novels were published, and that most of his comedy came from the characters. He just basically wrote what he felt was true. And there's a dark comic streak, I think, in a good deal of your work. To what extent do you think you're cognizant of that humor, or do you subscribe to sort of the Elkin kind of principle?
Listen, I just, you know, it's just instinct, I guess. It's involuntary. I really can't control it. I mean, I didn't really expect, and I really didn't want to do, a satirical take on modern parenting and McMansions and the suburbs and medicating kids. I just found it happening when I was writing about it. It's just part of my sensibility in terms of when I look at things. I mean, I remember someone wrote, Ellis manages to find humor where one would think none exists. It was a high compliment. It was actually Dennis Cooper wrote that about me. And so I said, gee, yeah, I guess that's true. But I'm not really that conscious of it. I mean, sure, I write something and I think, oh, that's kind of ridiculous. That's funny. But it's automatic. It's not something I'm trying to reach for or something I'm trying to aim for. It just happens.
But then there are, for example, in American Psycho, there are the Huey Lewis chapter, there's the Genesis chapter, which seem to me very clear sort of satirical passages.
Conceptual to me, more than satirical.
Really?
They were satirical in a way, but it was all part of the book's conception, which was detail and which was kind of like a madman's... list making. It was just supposed to mirror this guy's pathology, and I guess there's definitely a satirical element throughout all of American Psycho, but that was because that was where the impetus for that book began, and also with Glamorama, and I would even have to say maybe less so for the first two books, which were more autobiographically based, there was a certain level of anger that I had, and that anger is always transformed into satire. I think the greatest satirists are the angriest people, basically. And but that wasn't where Lunar Park started. Lunar Park didn't start from wanting to make fun of the world and wanting to, you know, I wasn't as pissed off. I guess I was just sad.
Would you say that maybe you were striving for poignancy with this? Because there was, for example, the Brett the persona. I'll just call him Brett for the time being. You know, reaching out to this son who, while simultaneously trying to sort of embrace the demon, quite literally, of his father. So there's definitely sort of a very different sort of novel from you with this, where there's a focus on family and there's a focus on responsibility. I mean, there has been, I think, a focus on responsibility underneath the surface of your texts before, but with this, I think it's more sort of clearly kind of within the actual actions. I'm wondering, you know, in fact, actually, one might even argue that this is perhaps the most sort of, I guess, in terms of plotting, there's a lot of action going on in this. Mm-hmm. Was this sort of maybe more of what you had in mind with Lunar Park, or are there any vestiges of this anger that you once had that was put to use in your previous books?
Not with this book. I mean, maybe in the beginning, there was, because I was angry about the fact that I really never had a father. And I think that's apparent in a lot of my books. I mean, it's certainly the central seed of the conspiracy in Glamorama is a father wants his son out of the picture for a couple of months, and because of that disaster, you know, it looms everywhere. The only anger was really about losing my dad as early as I did and not being able to resolve the conflicts in our relationship. We weren't speaking at the time he died, and I had a lot of problems with that, and I had a lot of problems with the fact that he was, you know, an incredibly abusive, alcoholic guy who created this like fear-based household that I lived in, and it was really scary. I mean, it was a really scary thing, and I had a lot of resentment. So writing Lunar Park, I thought, was just going to be, even using me as the character, okay, here's my shot at writing my Stephen King novel. This is going to be fun. Then it just happened. It started to become a much more poignant experience for me. And by the time that I finished the novel, yes, I know, I hate to admit this. It makes me sound like a wuss. It's mushy as hell. But something lifted off me. I exercised something about my dad issues I had about him were worked out during the writing of this book, which I should have always known. All the therapy in the world that I went through, all the long drunken talks at Sunday night dinners with my sisters where we rehashed all the crap about Dad coming up, you know, after the second bottle of wine. I knew none of that was going to help, and I should have known that writing the book was going to do it. And after I finished the book, we did keep his ashes in a safe deposit box in a Bank of America in Sherman Oaks, as the Brett in the Lunar Park does. And it's so corny. I mean, about 5 months, 6 months after I finished the book, and then we spread them. And I got to say, it's been it was a release of some kind.
But why is it being a wuss to actually go ahead and expose these feelings, whether in the course of writing or in the course of your own sort of, you know, personal sort of
Because I always kind of wince when I see people doing that on television, when I see these confessionals on Oprah or talk shows or, you know, people opening up about, you know, and wanting you to see how, you know, how it's enlightened them to such a degree and how ennobled they are by it and that you should be too. I mean, that always bothers me. But
that's, you know, television, though. That's not fiction. In fiction, there's this incredible layer of ambiguity and freedom that you have that you can't possibly have in television, because on television, they have to appease the sponsor. They're always going to a commercial break, whereas in fiction, you can run as long as you want, and you know. I guess what I'm sort of curious about is it seems to me that you sort of maybe hit a point of authenticity with this book in sort of coming to terms with these feelings. But you, at the same time, are telling me that, you know, you felt like a wuss in actually doing this. I'm just curious.
No. I feel like a wuss in actually talking about the real Brett's talking about what, you know, his feelings about his dad. I mean, I don't feel anything wussy about the novel. I felt uncomfortable just saying what I was saying in terms of how it was therapy for me, and I felt so much better once I wrote this book and my feelings about my father, all those angry feelings, a lot of them left, and then I spread his ashes, and that's the wuss that I'm afraid of. I'm not, no. Fiction is, the book is fine. I mean, and everything that the book says I have no problems with and is pretty valid. I just had a problem with what I just said, and I don't like seeing, like, celebrities or people on television, you know, recounting these, you know, these tales, these very personal stories, and telling, you know, people how, you know, enlightened they now are and how ennobled they are and what a good light you should see them in because they've come to some sort of terms with their past or whatever. I mean, that's what I was bothered by.
Okay, so basically you're just not looking to be sort of exposed, but yeah, at the same time, by putting Bret Easton Ellis in this book, you sort of open yourself up to sort of you know, introspection into your personal life.
Yeah, but I don't care.
You don't care?
I don't care, no. I mean, I did for a long time, but I don't care. I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, people can, it's not a problem.
Really?
No, I don't think so.
You don't have any, that just, if I were in your place, I would have significant problems with people constantly prying into my personal life, which really has nothing to do with the work.
But people actually don't. Huh. Not a lot of people do. And my personal life really is not that weird or interesting enough to kind of hide anything about. I mean, it really is. I have a very boring personal life, so I never...
Most writers do, you know?
So I really don't think... And I've never read anything about me that was untrue. I've never read... No one's... I've never come across any press where someone has written lies or written something about me that's not true.
Yet in the Suicide Girls interview, you sort of mentioned that your publicists had a problem with the way you were presented in the Time Lev Grossman profile.
There is
some sort of, you know, if you're not paying attention, somebody else is.
The PR people at Knopf didn't like the fact that I had gone to the bathroom three times during a luncheon interview with the Time magazine reporter. Literally, I swear to God, I'd admit if I was doing blow during an interview. I mean, I've admitted a lot worse. I wasn't. I had terrible allergies. I didn't want to blow my nose in this very fancy restaurant we were in, and I kept excusing myself to go to the bathroom. I had run out of my Zyrtec for my allergies, and I just gotten back to New York, and so I was having some allergy problems. But yeah, of course, Lev Grossman wanted to make it seem it was just too good. It was just too good to not use, I guess. Yeah. Bret Easton Ellis is going to the bathroom all the time, and his nose is a little stuffed up. But I was eating like a pig. Yeah. I mean, I ate everything that was put down on that table. I'm not going to eat anything. If I was on coke, I'd be chain smoking and downing vodka probably.
Okay. Just a really quick sort of question about 1941 is repeatedly referenced throughout the Lunar Park. I'm wondering if you have sort of this large World War II comedy that's sort of trapped inside you. Maybe you could elaborate upon that.
No.
No?
I don't.
You just have fondness for the film? Or?
Yeah, I do. Okay. I have a lot of fondness for the film. I actually did see that movie with my dad at the Cinerama Dome in 1979, December. I think it was the Friday night it first opened. And so that's why that was there. But no, I don't have a massive World War II comedy in me. It's just a movie that, I remember that night very, very clearly. And it just, because of that, I guess it means more than, you know, maybe if I had seen it with a friend or something. I don't know.
Do you always remember the exact sort of theaters that you see movies in? I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, I do.
Really? I do too. Really sort of freakish kind of impulse I have myself.
Yeah,
people don't understand it, you know?
If someone asked me about any movie I've ever seen in a theater, I can name what it was.
I can too. I'm glad I'm not alone here.
You're not alone, no.
That's good. So do you see a lot of movies? Would you declare yourself a movie person? Or?
Yeah, totally. I love movies. I go to movies all the time.
How many would you see a week?
On average?
Yeah.
Well, it depends. Like on tour, I can't see any. Yeah. So I saw a bunch before I left on tour. I can see easily six or seven movies a week.
Okay.
But that's what I do. That's what I do for lunch.
Yeah.
Because I take a break, and instead of having lunch, I'll go to a movie, and then I'll come back and work. And also, I walk out of a lot of movies. So basically, you're looking at maybe 3.5 movies a week, and so it's definitely more than the average person. But it's a compulsion I've had ever since I was a kid. I've always liked it.
Are they always multiplex films or are they art house films?
Both.
Oh, I wanted to ask you about the Jane Dennis fan sites. Did you have any input into that?
Or? No.
No?
None.
Really?
I had no input, and I just let the kids who are running the whole Lunar Park website do whatever they wanted.
Really?
Yeah, I really didn't. I was done with the book.
Huh.
I was done with the book, and it was like 6 months later, and all this stuff was going to be done about the book, this promotional stuff. And I quite honestly, I was tired of it, and I didn't really want to be involved. I think it's funny. I think it's funny. It's amusing.
Okay. Well, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about really quickly is probably my one American Psycho. Actually, no. Before I ask you my American Psycho question, I'll also ask you if you're aware of Vernon Downs by Jaime Clark.
Jamie Clark. Yes,
I must have mistyped it.
Okay.
Jamie Clark, where he has a young writer sort of obsessing over you and stalking you.
Yes.
Have you read this book?
Or? Yes, I have.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think it's funny.
Okay.
And a lot of it's true.
Do you think that such a book is necessary, or do you think a book needs to be sort of out there like this? That's just I found it actually through the Brett Easton Ellis Yahoo groups, which is where it was posted. I believe it came from Gawker initially, but
it was it reminded me a lot of Nicholson Baker's You and I, the book that Nicholson Baker wrote about his obsession with John Updike. And I thought it was funny. I've known Jamie for a long time. I can't say exactly that we're friends, but we're definitely acquaintances. And I know he's going to be, introducing me at the Boston reading.
Oh, really?
And we keep in touch. And he also did probably the best, most in-depth, interview, that anyone's done with me that appeared in the Mississippi Review. So I like him, and I thought the book was funny. And necessary or not, I mean, I don't know what's necessary or what's not necessary.
Really?
I don't know. I mean, sure.
Is there no way to gauge it anymore?
What?
There's nothing that you can actually sort of put your finger to and say, hey, that is totally unnecessary. In terms of art, in terms of novels.
No, not at all. When I got back to Jamie about the book, I said, you're being way too soft on me, and you should make this guy much more like me and much less seen through the eyes of the guy who is in love with him and stalking him and wants to be him. You should really, you know, throw some flaws in. I mean, I don't have any problems.
Helped him revise the book.
No, I haven't helped him revise the book. I just gave him some suggestions in terms of how I thought it would be a truer book.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Now, I wanted to actually ask you about American Psycho, my one question. Mm-hmm. In several interviews I've read previous to this, you've been sort of apathetic with regard to current politics or reluctant to talk about them. And yet, in American Psycho, your depiction of Patrick Bateman assaulting the homeless man, for example, is, one might argue, a political or a class-based passage, or even certainly a race-based passage in nature. And this was the very sort of passage that that Norman Mailer used in his infamous March 1991 Vanity Fair essay, where he just said, nowhere in American literature can one point to an inhumanity of the moneyed upon the afflicted that was equal to this. And the language that Bateman uses in that passage, get a job, struck me as very ideological in nature, almost foreshadowing even today what might be styled compassionate conservatism. So with this in mind, I'm wondering, is this sort of the product of a younger man, or is this something that, why the reluctance to think or talk about politics? Or to even put them perhaps in your fiction?
My anger in when I was working in American Psycho was actually quite personal. I mean, my anger was that, and no matter that I was successful. I mean, I came out of college and I was successful when I moved to New York in 1987. But still, you get a grasp of what society is like and how the world works and what's demanded of you as a man, and you think, this is fucked up. This is totally screwed up. The world is a mess. I've been in a bubble for so long, and then your consciousness is, you know, blown apart by disappointment and realizing what is expected of you, how you must behave, what life is essentially going to be like, and get angry. And I was very punky and nihilistic during that time. And so my anger was about, and I've always had problems with rich people. I've always had problems with rich people. People think that I grew up rich. I didn't. We grew up in an upper middle class suburb of California. I didn't grow up in Beverly Hills. I didn't grow up in Bel Air. I knew those kids, but we didn't have that money at all. And I've always had a problem with rich people, maybe because I wanted to be one. I don't know what it was. So it was, and I also saw a lot of bad behavior when I was growing up with rich people. And when my father did actually, after he divorced my mother and refused to have anything to do with his children, did become a very wealthy man. But by then it was too late. And then he lost it all when he died, so there was no money. We got none of it. We didn't get to see any of it. So anyway, And, you know, I don't necessarily, when I look back on that book, when I just read it, I realized, first of all, the book works because the narrator is very compelling and the book is funny and it's fast and it's, but I don't see it, I see it as an attack on society that I now see as kind of timeless. I don't see it based solely in the Reagan years. I mean, Jesus Christ, the Clinton years were 40 times as bad in terms of the misbehavior that was going on about the young dot-com billionaires that were running around Manhattan. That's when I really should have written American Psycho. So I don't think it was Reagan, Clinton. I mean, you get older, you realize it's always there. I mean, maybe Reagan was sort of like the wallpaper in American Psycho. But, you know, if you're telling me the 90s were any better, I mean, come on, let's get real here. Just because Clinton was in office, that has nothing to do with, I mean, that's just simply not the case. I mean, in terms of people's greed, people's desire for money, people who will do anything in order to elevate their status. Oh, dude, it got 100 times worse. So that was the real era of American Psycho, and well, I kind of wish...
The 1996 Welfare Reform Act that Clinton signed that put millions of, or not millions, but several tens of thousands of people now having to sort of work for their welfare instead of actually, you know, getting it, you know.
I know. But, again, the other reason that I don't talk about politics is that basically I don't follow them enough to... even come off halfway intelligent about them.
Really? Is it perhaps because it might make you angry? Is that another reason?
Yeah, well, it makes me angry because basically I think man is a very, very flawed creature. And I find it very frustrating that men and you know, base, I don't know, think that politics are a savior in some way. The same way that I can't stand religion, that people like, I don't understand how people can, but then on another level, yeah. I mean, we all want to feel safe, you know. We all want to be protected, and so I guess religion plays that part for a lot of people. And I guess politics is for certain people in this country, it's a very important thing, and it does affect their lives. When the last election was going on, I was living in Hollywood, and I was writing screenplays, and I was hanging out with a bunch of Hollywood people. And I was enraged by their frustration over Kerry losing the election.
Yeah.
It enraged me. It enraged me that these people who were never, ever going to be affected by anything that what administration was in power. And basically, this country, at least as long as I've lived in it, I basically think is centrist at heart. I think there's some religious stuff going on that I'm not thrilled about. But basically, I really don't think people are that far from each other in terms of a whole host of issues. I do not think we're divided that country at all. I think it's a big media-made thing, a lot of bullshit. But I do think that... I did get very, very upset the month leading up to that election, and I was very appalled by rich white liberals, you know, bashing Bush and thinking that Kerry, who was a horrible candidate, no matter what you think of Bush, was a terrible candidate, was going to solve anything, and their desperation and the hubris of most of them, and thinking that it was sickening. That maybe that was a problem. Maybe if I was living elsewhere, maybe if I was hanging out with some of my, I don't know, my middle class Republican friends, I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have gotten so upset by everything. But I was incensed to be in meetings all the time, working on movies, and doing screenwriting work, and have these, you know, very rich white people bitching about politics. It was ego. It was all narcissism.
But surely, for example, if Kerry had actually handled the Katrina crisis, he wouldn't have been playing guitar at an airbase in San Diego 2 days after, you know, this devastation had hit them. So it would have made some kind of difference, I'm sure, had Kerry been president and not Bush.
Really? Kerry, well, that would have stopped Katrina? That would have helped? That would have made...
It wouldn't have stopped Katrina, but it would have actually allowed him to be able to demonstrate leadership, where Bush, I would argue, did not.
I can never have, I never saw a shred of leadership quality in Kerry during the entire pre-election months. And I was for him, and I was for Kerry initially. And then I think the moment that I lost it was at the Bruce Springsteen Madison concert, where Kerry introduced Springsteen as, "Oh yes, this is a he's sort of like a singing minstrel. This is Mr. Bruce Springsteen, everybody." And it was just like, you know, he's just so. I mean, Bush is rich, fine, but Kerry is bad rich. Kerry is like super old rich, and just everything about just drove me nuts. But yet, I'm not political.
Yeah,
it's all aesthetics for me. It's all style. If you've noticed the way I've ranted,
yeah.
It's not about policy.
Yeah,
so I'm. That's why I shouldn't be talking about politics. That's why I should keep my mouth shut.
It's just basically a nice, expensive coat, whatever side you choose.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Do you feel that it would corrupt your writing if you were actually focused in on this? Or?
I lived with someone who was involved in politics for about 7 years, who ran gubernatorial campaigns and wrote speeches. And I got a pretty close, firsthand look at how it all works and the compromises made. And how basically it's sort of a tricky narrative you've got to move through, and it's just, and I was appalled, you know, and I was not interested in it at all, and the whole world of it seemed extremely corrupt to me, in a way that, for example, I think the corruptness of Hollywood, you know, seems kind of harmless compared to how corrupt politics are. And I think the hypocrisy of politics is really what probably galls me the most, and is why I'm not interested in it, and why, again, I must stress, I am not qualified to talk about it.
Gotcha. Well, one last question.
Yes.
Is Roger Avery going to turn every single one of your books into a film?
He only has the rights to Glamorama, and he's, you know, I just had dinner with him two nights ago in Portland. He was there for some business, and it just happened to coincide with my tour, and we had dinner and we talked about it, and you know, I've seen storyboards for it, and I've read two drafts of a script, but it's an expensive movie to make, and it's hard for him to find the money to make the movie.
Yeah.
He wanted to make it with Kip Pardue, but it's too expensive a movie to be made with Kip Pardue as a lead, and you know, that's kind of bothers him. And also getting money is tough, because it's about, you know, young Americans committing terrorist acts in Europe, and it's just not popular right now. So I don't know what's going to happen. But again, it's Roger's movie. He's going to do whatever he wants, and he's, you know, he is very single-minded, and I hope he gets it made. I'd like to see it made.
If Roger wanted to make Lunar Park, would you have him be the first person, or?
That's very interesting. Roger wanted to buy Lunar Park.
Did he really?
Yeah. I don't know why it didn't happen, but I guess it didn't happen. I think he had enough.
Really?
I think he has enough of my work, and I thought, if you let him make Glamorama, let's see how that turns out, and then if Lunar Park is still available, he can have Lunar Park.
Well, it's sort of like Frank Darabont and Stephen King. Roger Avery is your Frank Darabont.
I would like him to be. I mean, I'm a big fan of Roger's, and I loved how Rules of Attraction came out. Yeah, sure. That'd be great.
Brady Sinelis, thank you very much.
Turn up the TV, no one listening will suspect, even your mother won't detect it, so you're fine.